Barry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland, no compromise in defense of the truth.
KBOO is a proud partner of the 35th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 1st through the 4th. Buy your limited edition KBOO Festival t-shirt at kboo.fm/blues.
I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Bill Resnick and Jan Hocken focus on remaining hopeful in these trying times. Book mole Larry Bolden reviews Breaking Clean by Judy Blunt. Sharon Grant reads from the Zen Education Project's article Rethinking the 4th of July by Bill Bigelow. And from the archives, Jan Hocken and Fran Mikkel discuss the documentary What is Democracy by Astra Taylor. First up on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Bill Resnick speaking with Jan Hocken about remaining confident and purposeful despite recent events such as the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe versus Wade. Here's Bill Resnick and Jan Hocken for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, Jan Hocken. Good to hear your voice, that you're not too depressed by the many recent defeats us democratic socialists have suffered recently, and also the alarming prospects ahead. So welcome to this interview.
Good to be here, Bill.
You suggested that the political occurrences of the last couple of weeks were not unexpected, but stunning nevertheless, like the overruling by the Supreme Court of a woman's right to abortion, and just last Thursday, another hammer blow from the court that undercut any possibility for regulating powerful corporations and especially took the guts out of all environmental regulation. It's that bad. So there, and these, and a whole lot of other greatly upsetting features of the way this country is developing, all of it's depressing, and you suggest that we need talk about how to avoid despair and not get mortally discouraged, stay positive and active. So, Jan, I'm going to introduce you briefly. She started in Seattle, five siblings, became a nurse, then a therapist, and the head of the clinical psychology program at Portland State. Wrote four books, Hard Knocks, Domestic Violence, and the Psychology of Storytelling, hundreds of articles. Got into movie making, including Our Bodies, Our Doctors, and more recently, Necessity, Oil, Water, and Climate Resistance. And of course, she was one of the founding people of the Old Mole Variety Hour and still do interviews and movie reviews. So, Jan, we're talking about maintaining hope in hard times, mourning, grieving some perhaps, and recognizing defeats, but not getting too depressed. And why, for the planet, for this country and city, there is a lot of reason for hope and certainly action. Before that, though, Jan, let's remind folks of the trouble we've seen and are seeing, and especially the hammer blows just recently.
Well, many of these rulings of the Supreme Court of the last 2 weeks have not been surprising and have their own long gestational period behind them, but just the quick succession of Supreme Court blows to so much of the progressive legal advances over the decades, areas of public life that make the society livable, even in a modest way, have been attacked through this small group of people who has enormous power, a small group of very right-wing justices that have been cultivated and selected to do what they've done. And one after another, we've had these devastating opinions, outlawing abortion, blocking gun control, undermining Miranda rights, upholding prayer in school, specifically Christian prayer, and now most recently gutting the EPA, or a significant reach of the EPA. There was a 6-3 ruling declaring that the Clean Air Act does not give the EPA broad authority to regulate emissions from plants that contribute to global warming. They threw it back to Congress, knowing that no action is going to happen on that front from Congress because it's paralyzed. So it is staggering, not each of them alone, but in the aggressive force of their cumulative impact, kind of takes your breath away.
Yeah, and my sense is that's part of it. We've seen grim developments in U.S. life for the last, quite a few years. I think maybe we should talk about some of them. You know, one of them is, of course, Trump. He's still in the battle for the presidency in 2024. In fact, some people still make him the favorite due to the inflation and the difficulty of the other difficulties of the Democrats. Then there's the growth of this white supremacy movement behind him, the Proud Boys, the Oath Takers, and an angry working class. It's getting angrier. And all the petty bourgeois elements, the Republicans can come close to a majority. And because the political structure is so weighted to the small states, they can do minority rule as they are in many states in the United States, like Wisconsin, my home, where they never get a majority of the votes in the legislative election, and yet they keep it at 60% of the legislators, and that's going to go on. You know, there's also the Citizens United decision long ago, and Money in Politics, which helped cement their majority.
Yeah, that ushered in another era of difficulty in summoning hope for hard times, which limited any restrictions on the funding of campaigns and the control of money in our political system. But, you know, Bill, these developments have been around a long time. And so part of my approach to hope for hard times, whether it's on an individual level or collectively, is to understand our history. How do we draw on what we've learned from earlier periods of struggle? Because the struggle against the right wing and corporate control has a very, very long history, hundreds of years, depending on where you want to start. And the crushing of resistance, the impact of concentration of wealth on poor people, people of color, marginalized people, and these assaults all one by one collectively impact poor and marginalized people most profoundly, and people of color most profoundly, whether it's abortion, environmental impacts of, you know, the what's called sacrifice zones. People of color use this term to talk about areas that the right wing has supported dumping waste, including in West Virginia, where Manchin is from. You know, the level of poverty, or these states where the abortion restrictions, the criminalizing abortions is going to have the biggest impact, are where there are more poor people, more people of color who have higher maternity mortality rates, less access to health care for children that are born. So it's as though in some perverse way these justices rule that, you know, a fetus is a precious thing to protect until it draws its first breath of polluted air that leads to asthma at age two, you know. I mean, I think the inhumanity and the cruelty of this worldview needs to be addressed as well. And what has been in the making and politically pursued with steadfast strategic persistence for many decades, and then how do we deal with that? And how do we think intersectionally in the same way they have gathered up abortion, gun rights, protection of Christian ideals and conservative notions of the family, a very rigid, authoritarian, white supremacist model of an ideal society that has gathered around unrestricted capitalism and defense of the free market, as though freedom is defined by the freedom of capital. And so how do we respond to that with similar intersectional thinking? How we don't just deal with these blow by blow as separate assaults on what makes life livable, particularly for marginalized people, but how we understand it as a war on the poor and a war on the working class, a war on women.
Yeah, let me though a little bit challenge the notion that we can look back at our history and see similar periods, like in the Great Depression, for example, when there was a rise of a populist right that was very frightening. A lot of people thought Hitler was a great man. There was a streak within the Republican Party that supported what they think was strong leader leading the country out of this economic morass. I think the difference now is that the Republicans have that whole group of them, Republicans, the conservatives, the Republicans, the oath takers, the Catholic, the evangelical Christians, and a lot of the middle class, even, that's going downhill, and they're not able to blame how the economic system has been working, but they're very good at blaming the liberals and the state for all of our problems. And these conservatives also don't see themselves as cruel, incidentally, to the poor. They have an ideology that the poor are responsible for their own this is the land of opportunity. People who work hard do make it. There's plenty of opportunities still. And it's liberals and liberalism that undermine their, in fact, industry and their drive and their passion for education. And so they are, by removing all of these supports for their income and for jobs and for public services, they're doing a favor to the poor, although, of course, it's tough love. They'll recognize that, so they'll provide some support when unemployment gets enormous.
Can I take on that?
Yeah.
There are limits to how much weight we would want to assign to surveys, but there's research tracking public attitudes around these political questions for decades, and there has been overall a shift around these key issues for the right wing that have been kind of the anchor issues for the right wing. Now, for a long time, beliefs around abortion remain pretty stable, but yet a very small percentage of the American public wanted to overturn Roe v. Wade, around 20-25%, depending on how you ask. Most people support the legal right to abortion. There's also been a shift of views around racism as a problem in this country, as inequality, as a structural problem, less support for the death penalty. And in many areas that define our kind of a constellation of political issues, including gun restrictions, you know, the what are called more liberal positions are more dominant. In many ways, this country has shifted to the left on these critical issues. At the same time, there is a pretty strategic concentration of political power by the right, which is not to say that people can't be mobilized by these things. I think the abortion issue has been kind of an animating kind of moral banner of the right wing that doesn't have a lot of moral authority when they just want to reduce taxes on corporations or businesses. And so they've used some of these issues to project some notion of a moral as their moral compass. But as it's often pointed out, it ends pretty early. As you enter the world, you're on your own and have to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, if not by your booties as a baby. So I think the country has shifted, and that is important to recognize, that this is an increasingly a minority group of white supremacists that has disproportionate power and increasingly has power as they gerrymander their way to blocking voting rights, particularly for people of color, particularly for black people.
Jan, let's reintroduce ourselves. Bill Resnick and Jan Hocken, part of the Old Mole Collective. Speaking for themselves, we've been discussing the grim developments, especially the last couple of weeks, but in fact a long period in American life, one blow after another. And Jan began the conversation, which we will do again, of the possibilities of building the kind of movements that would be necessary to overcome the political power of the right and force the Supreme Court maybe to change its tune. The same men who tried to stop the New Deal because of mass movements and struggle and protests and disruption at some points, the Supreme Court members decided to step back and allow the New Deal period to go forward. So we do surely have possibilities for the movement. I think things are different today in many ways. One of them is that climate change is not going to wait for us to get our act together and is not going to change direction because a majority of the people want the rich to be taxed. Although on that point, John, I think people are really mixed. Depends on how you ask the question. If you ask, do you want to tax the rich, is that good? Should we do that? They'll say yes. Is it good to tax the rich if, in fact, it leads to less investment, which is, of course, what the rich says, or if it injures the economy because they're the entrepreneurs that bring the good things to life, then they'll be against the taxes. People are
there are generational differences on that question, too, and young people are less apt to...
Yeah, they're way less apt to support abortion restrictions. Yes, there's reasons for hope, and, in fact, that's what we should get into. But I think we have to focus on the basis for hope, without which things are not going to improve. But the basis for hope is the building of a great movement that, in fact, that the right cannot resist and that in one way or another dominates politics and, in fact, then gets the authority, wins the authority politically to deal with the climate disasters that will at that time be upon this country. Let's talk about those possibilities of that movement building, and then we'll have to sign off, and I promise you that this will be discussed on KBOO and especially the Old Mole for as long as we are still menaced by this right wing.
Yeah. I think there's tremendous potential for a broad-based movement or a united front in fighting the right now that we didn't have in earlier periods, including during the 60s and 70s, the Fight the Right campaign in the 90s. You know, Loretta Ross, who's been a very important voice in the reproductive justice movement and developed some of the key principles of Black feminist thought on reproductive justice in the 90s, has talked about how much earlier periods did not address the intersection of gender, class, and race in fighting for around justice campaigns. And that we, I think young people now who are activists sometimes get caught in what are seem like more symbolic victories, symbolic struggles, but yet those symbolic struggles, whether it's pulling down a statue or struggles over books and bathrooms that get trivialized by some, I think are ways of locally fighting these right-wing white supremacists and patriarchal intimidation tactics. So I think these are not trivial skirmishes, but there is a much broader struggle over who is controlling this country and the massive influence of the fossil fuel industries, the corporate wealth that drives a lot of these campaigns, including through the money that funds many of these justices that arrived on the Supreme Court. There's a difference between despair, discouragement, being afraid, and even feeling tremendous grief and sorrow and depression. Clinical depression, whether it's individual or collective, is when you can't draw on the representations of what's good or sustaining in a way to move forward. It's a kind of paralyzing state. Grief, anger, sorrow, these disturbing emotions, even moments of despair, are part of reactions to what's happening, but they are not in and of themselves paralyzing. And I think that's an important distinction to make, both individually and collectively, as we do experience this sense of grief and loss, but also kind of gather ourselves and support ourselves in moving ahead and not being mowed down by these very aggressive forces we're confronting.
Yeah, misery loves company, and company can strengthen us and be supportive of our ideals and commitments. And
yeah, and there's a history on mental health and activism that supports that.
Yeah. One final thing. I'm going to steal the last word, Jan. Climate science tells us that we're moving into a period of greater and greater and many climate disasters, storms, falling agricultural production, people desperate across the world, across borders into places where there are food and a livable climate. It's going to become very tumultuous, and dealing with, in fact, the global roasting is going to become central. And I think at least at one level, all of our movements must, the separate movements and the many, many issues that we are organizing around, they also have to have an environmental and climate change component. We have to build the recognition in the American people that our response to climate change will be superior to what the corporations, and they already are emerging with their plan, which is will enrich further the corporations, shock capitalism, but will never work, including, of course, nuclear power and other things. We have to develop a superior plan that attracts the American people. And in fact, we have it. We're doing it in cities around the world, not so well known, but in fact are now fossil fuel free in many, many ways. It can be done. And I think we all have to get behind that kind of plan, because that's going to become, I think, the fulcrum of politics. You want to comment? You're doing films on necessity. Absolutely right.
These two films on climate resistance that are both have the main title Necessity do feature indigenous-led movements around climate justice, each of which also centers on civil disobedience and the use of legal strategies, including the necessity defense, which is basically a moral argument. And I think we need to shift the moral discourse and focus on who are the real criminals in these situations, as the Supreme Court justices criminalize abortion, which is a very basic right of women over bodily autonomy. How do we shift the moral weight of so many of the problems that are troubling people onto the right wing and to the forces in advanced capitalism as they more and more aggressively pursue their interests, including the extractive economy that is itself in a state of crisis? And I think that's one way of understanding these aggressive grabs now, is that we are living in a time of crises, but how do we frame their crisis and not collapse under the weight of it?
Yeah. Well, it's a dual thing. We have to explain to people and help them understand what is happening in the world and why things are the way they are. But we also have to point out that another world is possible. That wonderful old epigram.
Yeah, and another world is coming, whether we like it or
another
not.
Another better world. Yes.
Yeah.
There's going to be one other world or the other world. Anyways, Jan, we have to sign off. Thanks a lot for talking
to us. Thanks, Jill. Yeah, I think we need to keep talking and strategizing on the Old Mole, but as a part of a larger broad-based movement that understands how all these issues are related in a very deep, profound way.
Yeah, Jan,
thank you.
So long.
Nobody knows the trouble that I've seen. Nobody knows my sorrow. Sometimes I'm up and sometimes I'm down. Oh, nobody knows the trouble that I've seen. Glory, hallelujah.
That was Sam Cooke with Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen from 1963. It followed Bill Resnick and Jan Hocken. Up next, Larry Bolden reviews Breaking Clean, a memoir by Judy Blunt about the life of a Montana ranch woman, her struggles to get an education and to write while raising three children. Patricia Kohlberg reads for Larry Bolden here on the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour and for Book Mole, Larry Bolden. Today, I'm reading Larry's review of Breaking Clean. Judy Blunt wrote these lovely snapshots of 30 years of life on wheat and cattle ranches in northeastern Montana as a memoir. It stuns me that I had not run across this book before finally gathered together as a book in 2002. Many, even most of my reader friends, had read this long ago. I'm happy I discovered the volume on a friend's bookshelf during a recent train trip to Salt Lake City. Quote, in August of 1986, I left Phillips County with a new divorce and an old car, with three scared kids and some clothes piled in back. We followed the sun west for hours, climbing mountain passes, crossing river after river, until we spanned the final bridge into Missoula. The kids started school the next morning, and within days, I started my freshman year at the University of Montana, the four of us holding hands and stepping together into a world of mountains and shopping malls. End quote. I have to suppose the title is ironic since the break was anything but clean. First, at 13, she fought against turning into a woman, then married a man nearly twice her age, whom she started dating at 15. A marriage more of inevitability than choice. Quote, I was 18 when I walked down the aisle on my father's arm. The groom was almost 30, a man of simple tastes and few passions, staunch honor and little experience. I joined him at the altar, bristling with independence, yet eager to please, desperate for attention, yet filled with fierce energy born of old anger. A riddle behind my homemade veil. From my parents to the unwitting hands of my husband, I passed the terrible power of judgment and award, the absolute authority I connected with love. End quote. Blunt understands how two-edged the praise was for tough ranch women, allowed to do men's work but never to own land or livestock. Quote, in my real-life Out West community, the depressing sequel was being written as I watched, and the work parts were harder to skip. I knew women savvy to the working of cattle and horses, women who rode the hayrake in June and took to the fields at harvest. But without exception, they picked up a thank you and walked back to tackle the work that was theirs alone, women's work. If I learned nothing else in my early years, I learned the scorn that twisted those words into insults. End quote. The prose in this book is simple, but so beautiful. Hard to believe she did not really start writing until she was in her 30s. I could easily make this review simply a string of quotes from the book. Quote, womanly arts be damned. I wanted the ease, the power of my mother, horseback. I wanted the real myth, and I set out to get it. That fall, as I turned 12, the sole member of my peer group defected. My cousin Lois turned 13, and despite our blood sister oath forbidding such things, she put on a bra, ratted her hair into haystacks, and kissed the hired man. I worked on my own appearance with grim determination. I spit and crossed my legs like a field hand. I peeled my nails off with my teeth and kept my hair bobbed away from my face. I preferred stacking bales and working cattle and ducked house chores when I could. I climbed trees, rode the milk pen steers to a standstill, and strung frogs 10 deep on a willow spear. I read myself into the strongest characters of half the Malta library. I made it last a year. And when, in the inexorable process of time, as my body betrayed me, my rage was terrible. dark brown hair, sun faded to the color of hay, ear length and shaggy, needing a wash. A big, raw-boned girl, my mother said, tall for 12. A square, horsey face, I thought, yet hidden by owlish glasses, chin jutting like a shoehorn, my father's chin, and his wolfish teeth wrangling for space behind my tight lips. That night, I tiptoed to the bathroom, selected a clean sock from the laundry basket, and gripped it in my teeth just in case. After dabbing my bare chest with alcohol, I attempted to lance my breast buds with a darning needle. End quote. Unable to prevent either her periods or her budding breasts, she finally succumbs to adulthood. While many of these little vignettes are sad or frightening, they are not without humor and told as only a born storyteller can tell them. I love this book. It returned me to the simple joy of reading. Judy Blunt is a tough and brilliant woman who finally broke clean in her 30s and pursued the education she had always dreamed of. She had to defy her husband and her community to do it. She shows us a tough ranch women's brand of feminism built in the crucible of hard work and bearing children. I have been talking about Judy Blunt's memoir, Breaking Clean. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm Patricia Kohlberg, reading today for Larry.
Battle Hymn of the Republic, that was John Batiste here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, and Patricia Kohlberg reading Larry Bolden's review of Judy Blunt's memoir, Breaking Clean. Up next, Sharon Grant reads excerpts from an article by Zinn Education Project's co-director, Bill Bigelow, titled Rethinking the 4th of July. Originally published in July of 2018, here's Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
This is Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Today, I'll read excerpts from the article, Rethinking the 4th of July by Bill Bigelow, from the July 2nd, 2018 Zinn Education Project website. It starts. In Portland, Oregon, where I live, the 4th of July holiday offers an excuse for a wonderful annual blues festival in Waterfront Park downtown. Unfortunately, in my neighborhood, it also provides cover for people to blow off fireworks that terrify young children and animals, and that turn the air thick with smoke and errant projectiles. Veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder are also at risk. Apart from the noise pollution, air pollution, and flying debris pollution, there is something profoundly inappropriate about blowing off fireworks at a time when the United States is waging war and underwriting war with real fireworks around the world. But the Yahoo of fireworks also turns an immensely complicated time in U.S. history into a cartoon of miseducation. For example, check out Ray Raphael's Re-Examining the Revolution at the Zinn Education Project, an article that every history teacher should read before wading into the events leading into 1776. Raphael analyzed 22 elementary, middle school, and high school texts and found them filled with inaccuracies, some merely silly, but others that leave students with important misunderstandings about U.S. history and how social change does and does not happen. Raphael offers some context for the Declaration of Independence. In 1997, Pauline Meyer published American Scripture, where she uncovered 90 state and local declarations of independence that preceded the U.S. Declaration of Independence. The consequence of this historical tidbit is profound. Jefferson was not a lonely genius conjuring his notions from the ether. He was part of a nationwide political upheaval. Similarly, Raphael reports that in 1774, common farmers and artisans from throughout Massachusetts rose up by the thousands and overthrew all British authority. In the small town of Worcester, only 300 voters, 4,622 militiamen from 37 surrounding communities lined both sides of Main Street and forced British-appointed officials to walk the gauntlet, hats in hand, reciting their recantations 30 times each so everyone could hear. There were no famous leaders for this event. The people elected representatives who served for one day only, the ultimate in term limits. Quote, the body of the people, Raphael pointed out, made decisions and the people decided that the old regime must fall. As Raphael concludes, quote, textbook authors and popular history writers fail to portray the great mass of humanity as active players, agents on their own behalf, unquote. Instead, textbooks credit great men, Washington, Franklin, Jefferson, and render all others as mere followers. And there's a lot more that complicates the events surrounding the 4th of July and the Revolutionary War. As Raphael notes, quote, not one of the elementary or middle school texts I reviewed even mentions the genocidal Sullivan campaign, one of the largest military offenses of the war, which burned Iroquois villages and destroyed every orchard and farm in its path to deny food to Indians, end quote. Nor do texts mention the indigenous resistance movements of the 1780s in response to American settler expansion, which Raphael calls, quote, the largest coalitions of Native Americans in our history, end quote. This is Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour, reading excerpts from the article Rethinking the 4th of July by Bill Bigelow. And he continues, in the book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, Gerald Horn, the author, points out that more enslaved Africans in the American colonies fought with the British than with the American colonists. As Horn told Democracy Now! Hosts Juan Gonzalez and Amy Goodman, quote, it makes little sense for slaves to fight alongside slave masters so that slave masters could then deepen the persecution of the enslaved, end quote. Included at the Zinn Education Project site is a link to Danny Glover, who performs one of history's most passionate denunciations of U.S. racism and hypocrisy, Frederick Douglass's The Meaning of the 4th of July for the Negro. Howard Zinn introduces Glover at one of the remarkable The People Speaks events. Douglass delivered the speech on July 5, 1852, in Rochester, New York, at a Declaration of Independence commemoration, and his speech begins, quote, what to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than any other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity, your sound of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciation of tyrants brass-fronted impudence, your shout of liberty and equality, hollow mockery, your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings with all your religious parade and solemnity are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour, unquote. His words call out through the generations to abandon the empty shout of liberty and equality on July 4th and to put away the fireworks and the flags. In the spirit of Frederick Douglass, the Zinn Education Project urges teachers to use July 4th as a time to rethink how we equip students to reflect on the complicated birth of the United States of America. This is Sharon Grant from the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've just read excerpts from the article Rethinking the 4th of July by Bill Bigelow from the July 2nd, 2018 Zinn Education Project website. Thank you.
Jimi Hendrix and the Star Spangled Banner following Sharon Grant reading from Rethinking the Fourth of July by Bill Bigelow. To conclude this week's episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour from the archives, here's Jan Hocken and Fran Mikkel discussing the 2018 documentary What is Democracy? By Astra Taylor.
What is Democracy?, directed by philosopher, filmmaker, and activist Astra Taylor, answers the question in the film's title through an expository style, an approach to documentary that uses interviews and images to build an argument. The argument advanced in the film is that most Western countries are being run by a really bad form of democracy. Taylor travels the world, meeting thinkers, activists, and philosophers who are troubled by the way democracy operates in their societies. She returns periodically to two main pillars of the film: group discussions at the original sites of democracy in Athens, and a large Italian mural depicting how democracy works, explained to us by Marxist scholar Silvia Federici. A mural that becomes a touchstone of the film in foregrounding financial oligarchs in dominating the ideology and practices of governance in much of the modern world. Well, Fran, many of us learned in school that we owe a lot to the Greeks in medicine, law, moral philosophy, and governance. And clearly, Astra Taylor thinks we have something to learn from the Greeks. What do you think we owe to the Greeks? And what do you think she's saying here in reaching back to this classical period?
I think we see a lot of things come out from the touchstone of the Greeks. Some of them good, some of them less good. Clearly, Plato's idea of the philosopher king is not something that we necessarily want to embrace. But there are a number of things that do come out. One is just the idea that governance should be about making a good life and ensuring the well-being of a polis, of a people, of a society. And then the question becomes, who counts as part of that society? Who's in, who's out? And that gets addressed in various ways in the film. But I think there are a number of other things that come up. One is this idea of moving people into different areas of the city so that the groupings would not be just based on friendship, but on proximity and the possibility of engaging with people who are not like you. That democracy requires a broader conception than just your friends and your personal relations, that it has to, in some sense, be about general well-being, not just your own interests.
And that's still a very radical idea that is far from realized in the world, that we have obligations to others beyond our friends, our family, our kin group, to represent people we don't know, that we all share some common interest, the idea of universal rights. It also seemed to me the idea was not to pull out the best model of governance from the Greeks, but to draw on that period of flowering of ideas around democracy, this idea that it's always contested, that there's a debate, and that there are competing models, and that this is more than deciding on a model. Just as today there is a discussion that's kind of new for this country about what is socialism? What is democratic socialism? Can we have any meaningful democracy under capitalism? And more than the answer, there's a discussion and debate around it.
I'm not sure that that's entirely new for America. There's been a strong socialist tradition in America back before the Cold War. There were lots of American socialists, but that is a tradition that we've forgotten. It's not something that the film addresses, but it does address various forms of democracy that extend beyond the notion of representative government, which is the more limited picture that we often get in school lessons and so on. There are some great moments where she interviews school children talking about, she presses them on, you know, is your school run democratically? Do you have a say? And the notion of extending democracy beyond going and voting every 4 years or every 2 years or whatever, and having a say in your workplace, having a say in your school, having a say in your daily life, having a say in your personal life, the idea that democracy is something that needs to extend throughout life, that all of life is political in that sense, is something that comes out in some of those conversations that I think is valuable.
people. I think the claim that, of course, is so much associated with feminism, that the political is the personal, that extends into how families are organized and run, how communities are organized and run. The question was posed, but overall it seemed that the film was more invested in exposing the hypocrisies and the false promises of democracy under capitalism, and how it's a cover for a small group of elites excluding others and running things. And I think there's a long history, too, of democratic experiments and fights over claims made on the state and on forms of governance, claims made in the name of democracy for having more democratic child-rearing practices, that you cannot dominate people or exploit people in the context of personal life, workplace struggles. So it felt this was a limitation of the film, is not acknowledging some of the history of fights that have won gains, that have made the society better in some areas.
Yeah, in the interviews with Cornel West and in some of the statements, there's a speech by Angela Davis in the film that we see clips from. There's discussion of this notion that democracy has never, in the United States or anywhere, has never been democracy for everybody, right? That the United States is founded on indigenous genocide, that it's founded on slavery, that it begins with all of this talk of liberty and freedom that does not include everybody. It doesn't include women. It doesn't include enslaved people. It doesn't initially include people who don't own property. There are a lot of limitations there. And I think the film does stress the ways that economic inequality really runs counter to the possibility of political democracy, rule by the people, of people's empowerment.
But yet early on in the film, Cornel West poses this problem that I think gets kind of set aside, that majority rule forms of democracy from below always have the potential for tyranny. And he even says for fascism, that there have been fascist regimes that have been elected democratically. And we see a lot of mass street protests and demonstrations. But how all of the uprisings from below translate into a democratically run society is, I think, the film is a bit facile on that front, how you get from here to there.
Cornel West mentions that, for instance, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which was a democratizing move, was not a democratic move, right? It was a presidential proclamation. That Supreme Court's Brown versus Board of Education decision was not democratic. It was made by the Supreme Court, which is this tiny body of people who are there for life. And so those are not democratic decisions, but they broaden the possibilities for democracy. He doesn't talk about, at least I don't recall him talking in this film, about the fact that both of those are responses, in part at least, to mass movements. I mean, there was a huge abolitionist movement prior to the Emancipation Proclamation. There was a huge civil rights movement. So those are things that are coming in response to mass democratic movement.
And I think victories need to be acknowledged and celebrated as well as critiqued.
I mean, Silvia Federici talks about the idea that the feminist movement has a really important theoretical accomplishment in stressing that the personal is political, that the domestic sphere is not outside of the political sphere. So, I mean, I think there's sort of acknowledgments of that.
Perhaps it's Wendy Brown who brings in this idea, too, that we have to think about democracy as not only the freedom to be left alone, which is kind of an American hyper-individualistic driven notion of democracy, being able to do what you want unbothered by the government, versus the democracy as being in relation to others, as understanding our common interest depends on the welfare of others. And that was introduced, but not very developed in the film, that distinction.
When she talks to the refugees and the people around the refugee camp in Piraeus in Greece about the idea of what they want, freedom or democracy, what do they want, what does it mean to them? And it includes safety, or it starts with safety and justice, that, I mean, people who are fleeing from violence and from unlivable situations are not in a position to debate the fine points of government structures. They want a safe place to live. They don't want to be shot in their beds. They don't want to be raped as they're crossing a border. They want to be able to have stable lives.
I think that the passage with refugees seemed limited to me as it was framed framed in a very kind of minimal, that it's not just about freedom to migrate, but freedom to stay and freedom to live. And the fact that you happen to be born in a country, why that gives people here any more rights anywhere else should be questioned. So it felt like the film kind of touched on some of these bigger problems and maybe a burden of any project of the scope of a film like this.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going from ancient Greece to the present day, you're covering a lot of territory.
Maybe the important point is challenging notions of democracy and how you can have different forms of it. But, for example, in Cuba, throughout much of the period since the revolution, there's been impressive local democratic practices, but also very authoritarian government. And so you have these mixed experiments, and I think some of that localism, local co-ops and that sort of thing are highlighted in the film without looking at some of the problems and coordinating them within the system of a state.
One of the places that she interviews some people is, I'm not clear it is in the film, that the trauma doctors she talks to in Greece are working at an autonomous clinic, that during the Greek debt crisis and betrayal of Syriza not following through on the referendum in Greece, the economic situation there was terrible. And so there were a lot of autonomous clinics set up to pick up the slack that was dropped by the government, which was stretched by the EU and the German bankers. And you know, those are great, but they're also things that really put pressure on, for instance, the doctors who are working pro bono in those clinics on top of their other jobs, if they still have other jobs. There were alternatives to the state that worked very well in that context, but do not mean that people don't have the right to make claims on the state, and we should be able to make claims on the state.
And maybe there's a similar dilemma around the Occupy movement. This also was an incredible experiment in local democracy and taking over public spaces and providing health care. But how you sustain these experiments in democracy over time is another matter.
One of the closing moments is Silvia Federici saying, you know, democracy is worth fighting for, but you always have to be very careful about what you mean by democracy, because it's a term that gets appropriated in lots of ways for lots of ends, for lots of things that we would not necessarily call democratic, that it's worth fighting for, and that it's always worth fighting for democracy from below, not from above.
And I think this basic idea that I still think is worthy of acknowledging its origins in Greek philosophy, that we have an obligation to understand and represent and share in the interests of people beyond our kinship group, beyond people we know. And it's still a very big problem in the world.
There's a group of activists in Miami talking about their experience. A lot of them are immigrants or children of immigrants from the Caribbean and Latin America. And one of them talks about the ways that people don't necessarily realize that understanding the experiences of people in different groups is important, and that what we all need to do is, you know, the African American needs to understand the Cuban American situation, and the Nicaraguan needs to understand the Costa Rican, and so on, that people need to draw on the different kinds of experiences and situations and histories that come from different places in order to build something better, in order to keep working for something better.
And that it's a more satisfying and fulfilling and larger life that also requires something of us.
Yeah.
Of learning, not maybe education in the sense, in the formal limited sense, but maybe a broader notion of learning how to be together across differences and how to understand different points of view. That's part of what's known as a democratic multi-tendency organization, that no one group has the line on things.
There's one point where Esther Taylor asks to what extent, I mean, it seems like democracy requires education, it requires intellectual engagement, right? That it's really demanding something of people. And then we move from there, I think that's where we move to talking with some of the students in the U.S. She asks them about whether their school is democratic, and of course it's not at all. Their needs are not being met, they don't have a say in what's going on, and that when they learn about democracy in class, it's just, it's government and checks and balances or something like that, right? It's not understood in a living way as something that occupies all of people's lives, but that it should be understood as something that is part of everyday life, that we need to claim a notion of democracy in the workplace, in the school place, and not just going and voting or whatever.
So all of the teacher strikes and the teachers fighting for schools as places of refuge, places where those without papers can get an education, where their kids can see a nurse, get health care if they need to.
Get food.
Get food. I find hope in teachers being so much on the lead now. And so it's not just access to college or access to higher education, but this kind of more radical notion of schools as public places and places for experiments in democracy. So this is Jan Hocken and Fran Michelle talking today about the documentary film, What is Democracy?
Morning with no place for my head. Thought about it for a while, then I went straight back to bed. You know they're trying to find you when wondering eyes are set. And every one location is sent to you by private jet. I have a way with words and not saying them.
Not saying them.
You know, I know they told you everything.
Everything.
It's not fair to write it down. It's not right to say it out loud. I feel so isolated from the crowd. Oh, yeah.
That's Bree singing This Is a Democracy, following Jan Hocken and Fran Michel discussing Astra Taylor's film, What is Democracy? And this has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for July 4th, 2022. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Bill Resnick, Jan Hocken, Patricia Kohlberg, Larry Bolden, Sharon Grant, Fran Michel, and Desiree Helligers. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of the Old Mole in time at kboo.fm. Just search for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.